Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 5th of March. The New Yorkers cartooning couple are guests this hour. They are the creators of many, many cartoons over the years in The New Yorker, which if you're like me, you read the cartoons and then you read the many fine articles in The New Yorker. And they met each other. They were both cartoonists, and they met each other at a party. Can you imagine this party of cartoonists for The New Yorker? And then subsequently got to dating each other and discovered they had a keen interest in the works of Thurber. And so we're going to be talking with the authors of Cartoon Marriage, Adventures in Love and Matrimony with The New Yorker's cartoonists. Liza Donnelly, who's been a cartoonist for the magazine for more than 20 years, is the editor of Section Sex and Sensibility, 10 Women Examine the Lunacy of Modern Love in 200 Cartoons, and the author of A History of Women Cartoonists, Funny Ladies, The New Yorker's Greatest Women Cartoonists and Their Cartoons. She is one of the original participants in the UN Cartooning for Peace initiative, which began in 2006 and continues all over the world, and she teaches at Vassar College. Michael Maslin began contributing to The New Yorker right out of college in 1977, has had four collections of his work published, co-edited Call Me When You Reach Nirvana and Husbands and Wives. Liza and Michael live in New York with their two daughters, Ella and Gretchen, and we're going to be welcoming phone calls for them. Our number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Or if you'd like to send an email, you could do that, and that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Liza and Michael, hi. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, I love the book. So,
thank you for having us.
Good. Yeah, our pleasure. Do your children think you're funny? Are you funny, parents?
Yes and no. they like to laugh, so they and their laughs are, our jokes are pretty subtle in the house. I mean, I shouldn't say that. They're not always subtle.
I think they're pretty good at identifying when we're trying to be funny.
Ah.
You know?
Yeah.
They're our best critics, yeah.
And then they roll their eyes.
Yeah, I would imagine. Have they taken up, how old are they?
17 and 19.
Have they taken up humor in some way in their lives, either cartooning or doing, you know, funny drama or something?
Well, they both have artistic sides, and they have been working on paper since they were little, because we always had paper around to fool around with.
Right.
I think they both have a great sense of humor, very, very dry, and that shows up all the time, and it's a lot of fun for us, because we're not that serious very often, but even when we try to be a little serious, there's a wonderful sense of humor they both have that turns things around quickly. It's kind of like a Jack Benny slow burn kind of look, you know, or something like that.
Right, yeah.
In terms of careers I'd pass for them at this point in their young lives, they're not heading in that direction. That's what you were getting at. I think they're like trying to strike out on their own, of course.
Right, and do something different.
Yeah.
So you met each other at a party for cartoonists. I would love to have been there. I wouldn't have been invited, of course, but I would love to have seen this party. When was that? You didn't really talk to each other very much at that point, did you?
No, this was in October of 1984.
Ooh.
And Liza was living in the city at that time. I had left. I'd been there a few years before. She was living in the city, and she had already made friends with a whole bunch of cartoonists. I was actually in upstate New York and kind of in the woods and didn't know anybody, and this was my first exposure to all the cartoonists that were at that party. And somebody brought me over to this group of cartoonists that were standing there and said, "Hey, everybody, this is Michael Maslin," and started introducing them, went down the line, and there were all these people. And at one point, as I've said this before, but it's so true, it's as if the seas parted, the cartoonists parted, and Liza came from, she must have been behind
the
wall.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
she was like behind this wall of cartoonists, and she came up right in front of me, and she has a great handshake, and extended her hand and said, "Hi, I'm Liza Donnelly," and that's when we first met. But yeah, that was it. We didn't speak after that at all, maybe for another year or something.
Cartoonists love parties. To get back to cartoon parties, it's because it's such a solitary business. You look forward to those moments when you can hang with your colleagues, even though you're competitors with everybody. You don't feel that at all in this particular. At least I don't. Maybe I'm naive.
And there are a lot of silly. When we get together, it's kind of a silly experience. It doesn't usually get very heavy.
Yeah, we don't talk shop usually.
No, it's just a lot of silly laughing, and I think we're all just very happy to see each other.
Right.
A lot of us have been together around that time of the late 70s. A whole bunch of us came in at the same time, and we've known each other all these years. So it's, you know, it's like a family.
Right. And at what point did you discover that you both had an affinity for James Thurber?
Oh, yeah, it was great. I think that after, you know, that initial meeting, we somehow met each other again. I don't want to use the word hooked up. Met each other again later, and got to talking and realized that we both had begun drawing or begun doing cartoon-like drawings because of James Thurber. I used to, when I was a little girl, I would trace his drawings. My parents had some of his books, and I trace his drawings, and that led to doing my own stuff. And Michael similarly had a beginning because of James Thurber. And when we both found that out, it was great because you don't always hear that from other cartoonists. They're usually real fans of Charles Adams or R. Crumb or Steinberg, but James Thurber, it's unique. So we were happy to find each other.
And it just happened to be, this was at a party after a party. This was in 1986, and there just happened to be an auction up at the New York Armory on the Upper East Side a few days later. And while at this party, I forget which one of us mentioned that, but we knew that there was a Thurber drawing being auctioned, and that was sort of our motivation for meeting each other. We called it a professional date, wasn't it?
And you had to bid on that together somehow, didn't you?
No, we didn't bid. We just looked.
Right.
Too risky to do that for a date, right?
Yeah, we didn't know if it was a date either, and we didn't really understand, you know, what was going on between us. So,
but from there on, it was uphill. We hit it off right after that.
Yeah, but he was, I think, at one point in the book, he says that he was thinking about you the whole time, and he wondered what you were thinking about, if you were really thinking about James Thurber and what was going on in the room, or were you thinking about him? Were you?
Sure. I was like, do I like this guy? Is this it? You know, what's going to happen? You know, all those things you think about on those first dates, because you could tell. One thing about Michael, I look back on those times, that I've been dating a lot of guys. How old was I when we met?
32
or something. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I dated a lot of men, and it was when I met Michael, I just couldn't stop talking. Like the floodgates opened, and for me that was unusual. I was not hiding anything. I was not trying to be somebody I wasn't. Mm. So I was thinking about him. I was thinking, is this it?
Mm-hmm. Isn't it funny how you wind up with somebody, or for some people it's somebody and then somebody and then somebody? But it is, isn't it such a strange process? And there you are with them for all these years.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
My sister said to me years ago before I was married, she said, oh, you'll know it when you find him. And I thought, oh, yeah, right.
Right. My mom used to say that. Yep, all the time. You'll know.
Mm-hmm. They say in the movies.
Yeah, you'll know.
But for me, it worked. I know it doesn't work for everybody, but I'm very lucky.
And the other thing that's very unusual is that you're both in the same business and you're working together on doing these wonderful cartoons. I just think they're lovely, in addition to being very funny. But that's not an easy thing for most couples to do, I would think, to work that closely together and to create books together and cartoons together. This was no easy task, was it? Or maybe it was.
Well, normally we don't actually work together. In the book, the drawings that you would see, say, in the New Yorker, are not things that we worked together on. What we did work together on are the comic strip-like introductory pieces, and the introduction itself, which I think is about 4 pages or something. And so normally in a normal day, like today, Liza was across the street working in her studio over there, and I was in the other house working in my room. So we do have a bit of distance between us when we work. But for those comic strip-like pieces, we sat in our kitchen and worked you know, just like 2 feet away from each other, and that was wonderful. We hadn't worked that much together before, so this was a lot of fun because it really was different. You know, instead of spending all these years by ourselves, we suddenly had someone else to talk to and play off of, and it was a very different and a great experience.
Luckily, it worked out. Yeah. It was gone really bad.
Yeah, worried when we sat down. We thought, well, you know, is this going to be trouble or is this going to be great? And it was. I can't even think of a time when it was trouble. Not to make it like a rosy-colored glass.
We did have trouble with the one chapter about fighting. There's a chapter in the book about how couples fight, and we thought about. Well, we didn't really fight. We had trouble coming up with the narrative about how we fight. So.
Why did you have trouble with it?
Why, Michael? We couldn't.
Well, we don't really fight. Like our fighting is so it's like verbal sparring a lot of it, and I think it was difficult for us to try to make that somewhat dramatic. So it didn't end up being dramatic. It ended up being quite accurate, I think.
Also, the narratives are about our lives together, but they're, and this is true of a lot of cartoons in general. They're oblique, you know, they give you a little bit of our lives, but they don't tell you all the details. So
right.
If you're going to tell somebody in a book about how you fight, you don't want to tell them all the gory details. It's hard to write about that, and I think we had trouble
right.
getting sort of poetic about that.
Yeah, it was an editing dispute, probably, more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say and what don't you say? And it turned out. We just kept working on them until we were both happy or tired.
Happy or tired. Yeah. It must be such an honor to have your cartoons in The New Yorker, isn't it? I mean, there are many of us who just love the cartoons in The New Yorker and for years have been looking at them and laughing and thinking that they're brilliant. What a great way to spend your lives.
Oh, yeah. I'm very honored. It's something I wanted to do since I was little, so to be able to do this as my life's work is wonderful. We both love The New Yorker. We are fans of the magazine itself. We're knowledgeable about the history and all the people that have come and gone there, the editors and the writers and the cartoonists. And it's a little world in and of itself, and we're very, very fortunate to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm. And how does somebody become a part of this very extraordinary world? How did that happen for both of you?
Let's see. Pare it down. In college, I submitted some cartoons, and they were rejected. I was drawing my own cartoons since I was younger. And then I moved to New York. I happened to get a job, a full-time job in New York City. And I just kept submitting cartoons. I would drop them off at the magazine and then come back the next week and pick them up. And I met a few cartoonists along the way, and you start to learn the ropes, like what to expect, that it could be a long process. Don't get discouraged. You have to do a lot of work. They want to see whether or not you have a voice, your own particular way of looking at the world or your own particular kind of humor. So they were looking for consistency of some kind. And so persistence is key. And luckily, after, I think it was a year and a half after submitting, I sold my first cartoon. But I tell young people all the time that it is persistence. It's not just having one good idea. It's about having a way of looking at life.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's how I got in.
Yeah. And Michael, how about you?
Well, a slightly different story. As we spoke of before, when I discovered James Thurber's work, I was about 16 years old. A friend of mine showed me a Thurber carnival with a very particular drawing, the What Have You Done with Dr. Milmoss drawing. And I had been drawing really strange, heavy-handed things before that, and was pretty confused. I was 16 about what I was drawing and where I was going. And once I saw that drawing, I really became obsessed with Thurber, and through him, learning about him, of course, immediately learned about, I knew about The New Yorker, of course, but really learned about The New Yorker and his world that had been. And at that point, I just really became convinced that I needed to be in that magazine and that I should be in the magazine. And so I started submitting, and I submitted from, not all the time, but from age 16 to
about
20. I think they took me when I was around 23 years old. And after I got out of college, that's when I really, really devoted everything I had to being in there. I moved to New York, and just that's all I did was do cartoons. And actually, the very first time I was paid for anything, any of my work, was by The New Yorker, which I was very happy about. But that, I mean, that's how it was for me, was that there was a determination to be in there. And, of course, we're talking about probably many, many, many hundreds and hundreds of drawings before they took one. Mm-hmm. And then once they took one, it was kind of slow, and then it has, you know, gone well over these last 30-some years.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess so. If it's been 30-some years, it's gone very well.
Yeah. Amazing to me.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any kind of similarities in the kinds of work that each of you have done that are in this book? I mean, is there something about your style of humor after being together so long that's there? Is there something about, because there is, as I said earlier, kind of a sweetness about all of this, even when you're dealing with some difficult kinds of subjects about matrimony and children and all of that. There's can you tell that you're married to each other, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, I think so. Although I think we came to the marriage with those sensibilities, not written in stone, but I think that's what attracted us to each other. One of the things, anyway. Similar sensibilities, similar approaches to humor. Sweet, but realistic, but, you know, light, but serious. You know, mm-hmm. all those things combined.
I think we do blend mm-hmm. at times. I was thinking of a drawing earlier today, and I couldn't remember if Liza had done it or if I did it.
Oh.
And I forgot to ask her, but and I really couldn't. I remember the caption, but I couldn't remember the drawing. And so I think we do overlap. But a lot of cartoonists also overlap with, you know, we're all thinking. I think many of us anyway are thinking about a lot of the same things, and I bet there's a lot of duplication that the New Yorker sees every week. But
in terms of ideas.
In terms of ideas. Uh-huh. You know, but, yeah, I guess we are the same sometimes, but we're not. Liza likes to say how, you know, I'll draw a talking pie or something, and she wouldn't do that. I don't know why she wouldn't.
I'm not against talking pies. I don't know how to make that funny. You do. So.
You do have a funny cartoon there where you both have pies in the kitchen, I think. And what's the caption? Do you remember that one? That you were throwing pies at each other?
Oh, right. That's Michael's, I think.
No, I think it was yours.
Oh, great.
I can't remember.
I don't know what page it's on, but I'll try and find it.
I know what you mean.
Yeah, you know it. And it makes me wonder, you must go through life. Because I go through life sometimes thinking about, oh, there's a talk show. Oh, yeah, there's a talk show. You must do that with just everything that goes on in a day, right? With a kitchen conversation, with what you're doing with your daughters, with all the stuff of daily life, because you're cartoonist. You're looking at life through the essence of what's happening in a funny manner.
Yeah, mm-hmm. you're right. We like to say that cartoonists are sponges. And so we... that's what we do, is we sponge up everything all day long.
We're not even aware that we're sponging it. By this time in our lives, we're sponging.
Without knowing. Right. We're unconsciously sponging. we're doing. We know, I mean, some cartoonists carry around little notebooks and write things down. I've never done that. But I do know that things come through later, sometimes years later, something that happened, or months later. Not in a particular way, but something. It could be a phrase or something I heard, mm-hmm. or a situation. There was only one time that I remember having an instantaneous idea from life, and it's too complicated to go into, but I do remember I saw a bus, a Greyhound bus, and the dog on the side of the bus. Immediately, I thought of a cartoon idea, and I drove home and drew it, and the New Yorker bought it. This is back in the early 1980s. But that was the only time where it was like, oh, you know, wow, that's an idea right there.
Hmm.
But normally for me, things percolate a bit.
Hmm. And for you, Liza, as well, or do you have that instantaneous cartoon?
No, not just walking around in life. I don't come up with ideas. You have to, like Michael said, we're observers and we're constantly sort of taking stuff in, whether we know it or not. And then when you sit down with a blank piece of paper, you try to put some of those back down on paper, like you'll draw scenes and then put words in the people's mouths. This is what I do. sometimes there's an instantaneous caption right then and there when you're, like, I'll draw a couple people and try to envision what they're saying. And when I'm visualizing that or what they're saying, or trying to recreate it, I bring in sometimes current events or situations that I've run into recently. So it's all mixing together. It's really, people ask us how we come up with ideas, and we really aren't sure. You just, I suppose it's like writers, you have to sit there with a blank piece of paper and you have to listen to yourself and pull in outside influences and doodle. And it's,
I think this is where Liza and I have a difference in working. She's very good at being, her antenna are way more sensitive than mine for what's going on right now, even though we both read the same newspaper every day. She'll be able to isolate something that can work as a cartoon a lot faster than me. So her work, I think, tends to be a bit more current and in the real world than mine.
Here's this fantasy.
Yeah, mine is more pretend, and, you know, I'm going to go back into medieval times or draw a fish or something.
Right.
But that, I think that's a big difference, is that her work, if you looked at her weekly batch, which I don't do, but if I did, I think I would see that she has a lot of current things, using current words and situations going on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just did one this week about Twitter, and I might be too late on that. Somebody might have beat me on that idea. So.
Let's welcome phone calls for our guests. They are the authors of Cartoon Marriage, Adventures in Love and Matrimony by the New Yorker's cartooning couple. Liza Donnelly and Michael Maslin are our guests. Liza's been a cartoonist for the New Yorker for more than 20 years, and Michael began contributing right out of college in 1977. And the book is very funny. It looks at, you know, the contents of marriage, the children, the food, the ex-whatevers. Is it worth it? Great ones on the dogs and the cats and sometimes the horses and the barnyard animals that may come into the marriage in addition to the children and the husband and the wife. So in bed, I do the story of the marriage itself, just part of what's in the book. Okay, the number is 800-486-8655. We have one line open if you'd like to speak with our guests. If you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, and let's start with Paul from La Crosse. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Hi.
I did sort of a joke question. I wanted to know if you guys wear a lot of black. But the other thing was that a few years ago there was a story in the New Yorker about Submission Day, or whatever you want to call it, where all the cartoonists would come in from around New York and have to sort of sit in this waiting room and submit their cartoons, and then yay or nay. And I was wondering, in the age of the Internet, has this changed at all, or are some traditions still true?
Okay.
The black question. Liza is almost all in black.
I'm addicted. I'm sorry. I'm not from New York. So
I'm wearing black socks, and that's about it. My shirt is charcoal gray, so I'm heading towards black. But,
Do you know why you wear black a lot or all the time, Liza?
It's easy.
Really,
that's the reason, I think.
Uh-huh. She's invested so much money in black clothing now. She's got to wear.
Well, I have jeans on, but it's just, I don't have to match colors. You know, I just have to put on the shirt and go.
Okay, and there's a cartoon about that, isn't there?
Yes, there's a narrative about that. My obsessions.
Right,
Michael's amused by my black top collection.
Right.
The other question, yes, that has changed in the last 20 years, of course. When I first started out, you didn't have to go into the magazine to submit your work. People mailed it in. But I went into the magazine and you had lunch with your colleagues. But that tradition still continues. We go in and sit in that little waiting room and wait to go meet with Bob Mankoff, our editor, cartoon editor, and he'll pull out a couple of your cartoons out of your batch, and then the next day or that week he would take them to his senior editor, and they would choose. And then we would all go out to lunch, so it's like the cartoonist's Friday night to relax. But now we live outside of the city. I don't go in very often, and we fax our work in. And then if you get an okay, you FedEx it. You send it through the mail.
Oh. Well, the other way sounds like so much more fun, doesn't it?
Going in?
Yeah.
Oh, it is fun. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that tradition does continue.
Yes.
People are there every week.
Every week. So you can go in. Although, we had a nice crew of friends that Michael didn't do it, but I had a nice crew of friends that I would regularly have lunch with. And I don't know the new cartoonists as well, but it's still fun.
Mm-hmm. Michael, were you going to say something?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. Let's go to Chris from Glendale. Hi, Chris.
I wonder what you have to say about two topics. The first is Bruce McCall's writings and images. And the second topic is the New Yorker parody, which was a very nice trade paperback in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
That parody of the New Yorker was immensely detailed, down to the illustrations,
yeah,
and cartoons, and fonts, and articles, and movie reviews. I just wonder if you're familiar with both of these categories.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well,
mm-hmm.
The parodies, we actually have a collection of New Yorker parodies. I love them. So I've been buying them whenever I see them on eBay.
Obviously a collector, too, the caller.
Pardon me?
Chris,
are
you
a collector of some kind, aren't you?
By the way, I should add that the one parody that I find the best is the 1986 book, and the formal title is Snooze, the Best of Our Magazine.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
I have to remember.
Yeah, actually, we don't own that, and the only reason I didn't get it was because I know I can get it whenever I want it. I like buying things that are hard to find.
Mm.
So our parodies are things back into the 40s, colleges put them out, and a wing of Mad Magazine put one out a while ago.
People love to make fun. I'm sorry.
Yeah, they're all wonderful, and they all do a great job of Mad Magazine did one. They all do a great job of using the Irvin typeface and copying the drawings in a way, not exactly. So they're all wonderful things. I do remember that book well, and Bruce McCall, I don't know him. Of course, we know his work very well. I'm not so sure what to comment on about him other than he's a very talented artist and writer. I don't really know. I have lots of favorites in the magazine, and it's probably easier to name enemies or something.
Thanks, Chris, unless you had something else.
Oh, I just wanted to add that Bruce McCall and the book called Snooze, common to both is restraint. Mm. There's no easy laugh. There's no cheap laugh.
Mm-hmm.
The New Yorker parody called Snooze is remarkable because so much of it is deliberately low-key, mm-hmm, almost boring.
Well, maybe that was part of at the time when that came out, I think there was some chatter that the magazine had gotten a little dull.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that probably reflects the feeling at the time that I know a lot of these parodies that we do have, sometimes the drawings are really boring.
This is the 80s.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but the other parodies as well, there's some from the 50s we have, and I think they are reflecting the feeling that was around, especially in the late 50s and the 60s, that the New Yorker had gotten kind of staid, and the humor wasn't really reflecting the times.
It's interesting because that we heard through the grapevine, that's one of the reasons why Tina Brown was hired. And when was she hired? In 90-something. To spice up the magazine, to really make it more relevant, more alive, although I thought it was always alive, but more splashy.
Mm-hmm.
And then she did that. But when the magazine started, it was very, very splashy and very alive and very connected to what was going on in the world, or not in, in a humorous way. So there, in a way, it was going back to its roots.
Thank you so much for your call. Nice to hear from you, Chris. Let's go to Mark from Milwaukee. Hello, Mark.
Hi, thank you. I love the New Yorker. I love the cartoons in it. It's almost like, as if it's about 50% of the political comment comes from the cartoons alone. But what I was wondering here is, I'm looking back through past issues. I cannot find a Donnelly or a Maslin in the issues.
January 5th was my last one.
Okay.
And if you go back before that, I was in the issue before that, and probably the issue before that.
Yeah.
There's like a mystery of how things are put in the magazine. They have what they call the bank, and they buy things. And sometimes you'll see something immediately. Sometimes you won't see something ever. They have things in mind that from 20-some years ago.
Really?
Been published. Yeah. It's a mystery how these things go in and when they go in and why they go in. I don't know if you have the New Yorker complete collection or anything, the caller, I mean. You can easily see when these drawings were in. Liza was in right before Christmas, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're in, I think, you know, I've always wondered what's better. Is it better to be bought or better to be published? And it's better to be bought and know that they have the work than it is to see the work for us,
mm.
if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's there. It'll come out. I'm guessing there'll be something of mine in next week.
Hmm.
So I don't know if that answers the caller's
question. Yeah, sure it does. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Tim from Wausau next. Hello, Tim.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I'm curious to know if either of you ever finish a piece and you just crack yourselves up.
I don't know how to answer that.
I think it's crack up like actually laughing out loud. That kind of thing.
Well, sometimes I've done some artistic things, the drawings and paintings, and written down ideas, and sometimes just the reality of seeing it on paper just cracks me up much more than the original abstract thought of it.
I think it's a very, at least for me, I can't speak for Liza in this, but when I do something that I really like a lot and think has a really good chance, it's a very pleasing feeling. It's, I don't know, it must be like hitting a ball or something, or catching a great catch, or I don't know. It's a wonderful feeling. It doesn't generally result in laughter, but it does sure feel good to know that that's happened. I mean, that's what we're working for every day, is to do something that we are really happy with and feel good enough about to send in to the New Yorker for them to consider.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get that home run feeling even before, just after you've finished a piece?
Yes.
Before you've submitted it?
Yes.
Yes, sometimes.
Okay.
Not every time, but
yeah.
Obviously.
I like that, to get that home run feeling at least once a week.
Oh.
Wow.
I like to get it. I didn't say I did get it.
And it's hard because you'll get the home run feeling and then they don't pay any attention to it. They don't buy it.
Oh.
Well, that's the dark side of cartooning.
Yeah. Right.
You have to get used to that.
One last question. Mm-hmm. Do you take figure drawing classes?
Not anymore. I did when I was in school and college. Because I used to feel that, and maybe for my drawing, it worked. Knowing the human form is helpful as a ground, as a basis for abstracting from that. So you know, if you know how the body's supposed to go, then you can do a cartoon figure that is, has some basis in reality, you know what I mean?
Right.
But that's not necessary, because you look at people like James Thurber, for example, who didn't know how to draw at all, yet his drawings work beautifully, so I don't know.
That's right.
Yeah, I was an art major in college, and I took a lot of figure drawing. At the time, I was also drawing cartoons, and I didn't know if I knew that they would be connected. I wasn't really sure about that. I don't know if it even paid off. I was trying to draw someone holding a penny yesterday, and it was very difficult for me to draw that little penny held by two little fingers. I crumpling up the paper and throwing it away, that doesn't look right.
I know that sometimes cartoonists like Alison Bechdel, who's a graphic novelist, she poses for herself and takes photographs of herself in order to recreate the drawings in the narrative.
Yeah.
Her stuff is very realistic. No, it's not. It's more realistic than mine, but I know some cartoonists do pose for themselves.
Cool.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thanks very much for the call. So did you finally get the penny down the way you wanted it, Michael?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Well, what I do anyway is I cheat. It wasn't working one way, and so I completely shifted the way the man was holding the penny so that I didn't have to draw the hand so well.
Yeah. That sounds familiar.
Yeah,
moving really. Things around so you can draw it.
Right. Right.
There must be, and I'm sure you get this question a lot, but there must be days when, or events that happen in your lives that aren't very easy and you're feeling down. And do you have the luxury after having done this for so many years that you don't feel a need to produce when you really feel like you can't produce?
Well, I think we both approach our work as like somebody else would go to work every day. And so there is this day ahead of us where we're going to go and sit at our desks. And unless it's something really nasty, we try to work our way, at least I do, I think lots of us, work our way out of whatever that thing is and go to work. And I think there's probably days when there's a lot more making of coffee and checking email.
Right.
If there's something that's in the way. But for me, the best days are when I am completely apart from this world, the world and its worries, and put on music and just kind of think or not think too much and draw and work with words. So, yeah, it can be intrusive and it can work against you, but I think the word discipline, we've said to people, it's very, very important to have that for cartoonists, I think, or for us, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You
keep really, the engines oiled.
Right.
Oil, yeah.
You can't just say, oh, I'm blue today. I'm going to go, you know, down to New York and walk around.
Just try to draw something. Try to draw something.
Right.
Keeps you. I know writers say the same thing. Just write one sentence. At least you feel like you've done something.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. So we keep working at it pretty much no matter what, unless it's something enormous.
Right. More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, and our guests are the cartoonists and the authors of Cartoon Marriage, Adventures in Love and Matrimony by the New Yorker's cartooning couple, Liza Donnelly and Michael Maslin, and they have been with the New Yorker for a number of years. The book looks at marriage, actually, from, you know, meeting each other and deciding to get married and the marriage itself and the sexual relationship and the children and the dogs and the cats and the horses and the fights and all of that done by these New Yorker cartoonists who are married to each other. Here's our number. Join us if you'd like. 800. Lines are open now. They were crowded. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Or the email address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guests are cartoonists who work for The New Yorker and have for many years and are married to each other and have a wonderful book out, Cartoon Marriage, Adventures in Love and Matrimony. Those of you who listen to me know that I love dogs. I just love dogs. And they have a wonderful section, Friends Fury, What Is That Smell? One of the strips goes, we began as a two-cat family, then we got a big white dog, and then we got another dog to keep the big white dog company, and then two more cats, and then a couple of horses, of course, a couple of guinea pigs, a snake, fish, hamsters, a rabbit, an ant farm, a mouse, gerbils. We didn't intend to have a circus, but we got one, and there are a whole series of cartoons about their pets, which I think are just wonderful. Don't you just love having animals around, but you never thought you would? You have a lot of them, don't you?
We do. No, it's less than it was once. We have two dogs, two cats, two horses. That's a lot, I guess.
That's low for us.
That's low for you?
But, you know, when the kids were little, it, we had trouble saying no to the guinea pigs and the snakes and the... We just like animals.
Mm-hmm.
Liza has one of our dogs, a Jack Russell named Bernie, is right behind her as we speak.
Oh, a Jack Russell. They seem so darling, Liza, are they?
This one is.
Yeah.
I haven't known many, but this one, he was a rescue, and I think he's just so, he's like a perpetual child. He's just always amusing.
Yeah. What is it about, and I find this is true about, I just love... every day after the Westminster show, I always clip the dog, you know, that won the show, because I love cartoons about dogs, too. And then I noticed yesterday, I watch NBC News for some reason every night. I just have it. And they are doing all kinds of dog stories now, which they say is to lift up during hard times. But, I tape it so I can watch it twice, and then I show the dog story to other people. Look at this wonderful story about the helping dogs. Do you like doing dog cartoons, and why are many of us just needing them right now for some reason?
I love doing dog cartoons. Did one the other day. I can't remember.
Did you?
Yes. I can't remember what it was. But, they're just so, I don't know. I guess we think of them, Liza and I really do think of them as equal members of the family almost.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way they act anyway.
They give you unconditional love. The research says that if you have a pet, it keeps you emotionally stable or something. It keeps your spirits up. So.
Right.
They're fun to draw too. They can do things in cartoons that people find amusing. If a person said it, might not be quite so amusing, but if a dog says it is, it is. Especially if there's a cat involved or something. So there, and then our Jack Russell is just a wonderful example of a dog you'd want to draw, because he has these great ears that are comical.
Aww.
They just make you smile when you look at the ears. You know, you're already there, really. The other dog is quite old. She's a Basset. She's, I guess she's about 100 years old in our years or something.
Oh. Oh, my.
But she's just, you know, she's retired and just hangs out.
Did you find that there is sort of this need for animals, for their constant companionship and, you know, making us feel better, that during times that are a little tougher, you have more of a need to draw cartoons, and also that the magazine would want more, you know, animal pictures?
I don't think that way. It might come, as we were talking about before, it might come through that way, that I have a sense that this is a good time to draw comforting things like puppies and dogs, and I might end up doing that a few weeks later, but I don't actively think that way. See, that would be the difference between Liza and I. If she saw that there were, and now you've told her, that there are a lot of dog stories, this is going to play on her, and I think she might, who knows.
You know, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No.
I just thought of this, that one thing about being a child is that most children want pets, right? They keep asking the parents for pets. And in many ways, I think Michael and I aren't really convinced that we've grown up. So that's one reason why we just kept getting pets. It's like, well, we have our own house. We run the show now. We can get another pet. Why not? No parent telling us not to.
I think when we got the third dog, I was wondering, why did this happen? I don't really know.
Right, at that point, you get like, okay, maybe that's enough.
Just because she was cute.
I like that. And I remember the cover, it wasn't all that long ago, it was a wonderful cover about Obama vetting the dogs on the front. I just thought that was a wonderful cover. And it is amazing how many people, I even sent the White House a note about
think that they should get?
Well, I actually told them they should go to John Katz, because John, you know, has got this Bedlam farm and really knows how to pick. I thought they probably ought to do, because of the allergies in the house, they probably ought to do a litter that is known to be gentle, et cetera. I didn't care about the dog. But John Katz, I think, writes beautifully about them. So I just gave them information. Please contact John. I would go to him to get the dog for the White House. And but I think they chose all right. What do you think? I think that if they can find a rescue dog who's hypoallergenic And, you know, they're the president and the first lady, and I'm sure they can, right?
Oh, sure.
They'll find it.
Yep, they will.
Yeah.
And it'll be an exciting day when they do. The country will be... I mean, who wants to think about Wall Street when they can think about dogs?
I know, you're right. When you can think about the dogs. Yeah. And I thought that was coming yesterday with the last item on the news that there's something new at the White House, and I can't believe I'm so into this. I think, oh, great, they got the puppy, and it was a swing set. But,
they're going to be waiting for the spring, I think I heard, right?
Yeah, March or April. I can't believe I know this much. April 1st. I can't wait. I'll get a picture of that. We have an email, people wondering, how many cartoons are you required to print in a certain time?
There's no requirement to, although, and there might be, if you haven't sold a cartoon in several years, I don't know what would happen. And they just wouldn't buy you anymore. I don't know. That's a funny question. You're not required to submit any particular number. The routine is most of us submit weekly 6 to 10 ideas.
Do you really? That's a lot.
Well, I've known cartoonists in the past who've done more, like 30.
Ooh.
So it depends on your own style. Like some people edit themselves before they draw. So in other words, you come up with an idea. Just some cartoons just draw it, and they don't edit themselves. So that if you do it that way, you end up with a lot of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we send in about 6 to 10 a week, and you know, some cartoonists sell every week, and some sell 3 times a year, and it varies.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no. A lot of us have contracts, and the magazine. In the contract, it doesn't ask you to do anything but make sure you send your work to them first before you send to anybody else.
I see.
So that's the requirement.
Right.
You know, if you want, you could send in one a week, but sort of hurting, you're shooting yourself in the foot by doing that. It's better to work more than to work less.
Mm-hmm. Another email from Kim. Besides Thurber, what other New Yorker cartoonists who've preceded you have been particular favorites or influences, and have you ever had the privilege of meeting and talking to them in person?
Yes, let's see. I was so privileged to be able to meet William Steig. Maybe 20 years ago, I was a cartoonist. I was thrilled. He's the author of Shrek, for those of you who don't know. He's also a New Yorker cartoonist and did wonderful children's books. A number of people, Bob Weber is one of my favorites. People may not know these names. Roz Chast is a good friend of mine, and I love her work. Michael?
Well, I think when I started learning about the history of the magazine, I started really loving just about everything I saw. I mean, that sounds a little
bit... That's not true.
No, I think I did. I mean, I'm saying when I learned about the history.
You.
When
yeah,
learned,
right.
You know, the so-called golden age of New Yorker cartoons.
Which was when, 30s?
In the 30s mm-hmm. and the 40s. If you look through those things, you can't help but love these cartoonists. And so I think I picked up an affection for a lot of them. And then, you know, the big names, of course, we all revere Saul Steinberg and Charles Adams and George Price and Ed Koren. These are all people.
Helen Hokanson.
I got to meet Charles Adams just briefly a few years before he died. And that was a huge thrill. I had stood behind him in an elevator in the New Yorker when I first started at the magazine, but I was too scared to say anything to him. But then at a party, he was coming my way, and I just couldn't help it. So I introduced myself. That was fun. But we have met a lot of the people, almost everybody, I guess, that has been around since... Well, there's one fellow, Al Ross, who started in the 30s, and he's still with us. So we've, you know, it's not that big a crowd, so you end up meeting almost everybody
sure.
at the parties if they come to them. Mm-hmm. So we have met, I'm looking up, we have a beautiful photograph on our wall from 1947 by Irving Penn, who gathered a lot of cartoonists, and I realized not long ago that we had met many of those people, and they were grouped together in 1947. I met Steinberg, I'm looking at the photo now. Been in the room at least with a bunch of these people, didn't talk to some of them. So yeah, that's what's great about it too.
Right.
You know, you get to meet some of them.
Right. Thank you both so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
It was wonderful. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right, bye.
Our guests are authors of Cartoon Marriage, Adventures in Love and Matrimony by the New Yorker's cartooning couple, Liza Donnelly, a cartoonist for the New Yorker for more than 20 years, and Michael Maslin, who began contributing right out of college in 1977. The book has just been published by Random House and is a delightful read. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader, our on-air producer for many years now here in Milwaukee. Thank you, John. And thanks for your calls as well. A lot of fans out there of The New Yorker, deservedly so. I'm Kathleen Dunn. I'll be with you again on Monday for All Things Political at 9 here on the Ideas Network.